Hello, and welcome to In Line with Nature, the podcast that explains an approach to building that puts the future of our planet first, with me, Hannah McInnes. In this series, I talk to experts about modern-day construction, its impact on the natural world, and why the time for change is now. I'll be talking to our series of guests about new approaches to design, reimagining a built environment at one rather than at odds with nature.
Hi, my name is Indy Johar from Dark Matter Labs. I'm one of the founders or the founder of Dark Matter Labs. And I suppose my journey has been focused on how do we think about the things that are not visible and how they make the world around us. So people often talk about the house. Actually, the house is important, but the house is made out of ideas of ownership, ideas of land, property rights. These things that are behind the things that we see visible, and they're the implicate order. They imply the order into the world around us. And that we're focused on designing and reimagining those things, because we think the crisis that we're living in is not a crisis of our material world. It's a crisis of how we relate to the world.
Could you tell me, it's a very basic question, but I'm really interested to hear from everyone, what the built environment, which is obviously what we're basing all of this around, what that word, that phrase means to you?
Increasingly, I think in an age of entanglement, I think when we take even a house and you look at its relationship to the soil it destroys or doesn't destroy, its relationship to the ecosystems it provides, its relationship to the material supply chains it drives around the world, if you look at actually the impact it has on human life and the indoor air quality, the indoor light pollution, the indoor quality of space and its implication on our imagination, how we think, all these things are now interrelated. I think the biggest challenge that we have is that our context is firmly entangled. The house is not just a materiality of our experience of residence. It impacts our mental health, it impacts our quality of sleep, it impacts actually our length of our lives if we're living in noise pollution, and also the materials of the house and how they dig up the world, how they embodied carbon impacts our global planetary relationships. I think one of the challenges that we're living in is the challenge of this entanglement of the problem. No object is isolatable. The built environment is not isolatable from the natural environment, and the entanglement is full and proper. So I think we have to talk about the human environment through an entangled lens, and we have to talk about this in a different way, because I think we, you know, increasingly you're hearing cities talking about rewilding cities. We're trying to, when we start to recognize the power of microbiomes in our built environment for our fundamental human health. So I think the built environment, or in an age of the Anthropocene, you would argue that all the Earth, all the planet is part of our built environment.
Expand on that, what you just said about microbiomes, for people who don't know what that means.
So our health, our physical health, is a function of our microbiomes, and our microbiomes are also, so in our built environment, we largely anesthetize all our built environment. But actually, we know our physical health is very much related to our microbiomes in our environment, but also in our gut. We know how we think is a function of microbiomes in our gut. And when we take a One Health view of the world, it's become very clear that how we relate, how we think, how we behave is functionally much more embedded and encoded into our built environment. So, for example, I think there was some piece of research done that looked at the microbiomes of the five most expensive neighborhoods in the world. And what you found was very easily that they shared a microbiome. So what's really interesting is that kind of this microbiome capacity is a fundamental effect on us, our well-being and our thinking. So that's just one aspect of it. Children who are playing in soil, playing in healthy soil, have a much healthier immune system. They have fundamental cognitive impacts. And that's just at the soil level, which is mass microbiomes. But actually here, everywhere around us, we've designed everything to be antiseptic.
So how do we do tangible things to get out of this place? Because we're quite waded deep in this modern mindset. I mean, normally you want to become unentangled, but you want us to become entangled. How do we actually do that? I know you're involved in many practical organizations.
I think we have to recognize this as a 1 in a 400-year-plus revolution. So I think, firstly, just recognizing where we are. We've lived through an idea of last 400 years of, one, isolating humans from the built environment, objectifying ourselves. And, you know, you would argue Vitruvian Man, which was the concept of putting a human, a male, in a circle and a square, was about actually the Platonic idea of the human. At the same time, you had stuff like Newtonian physics, which constructed a worldview which is about actually seeing the world, cause and effect was actually seeing the world through dead eyes. Every object was dead. Cause and effect assumes a kind of a physics of dead things. And actually what I find is interesting is increasingly as we start to see life, what does that start to mean? So I think there's a kind of moving from the economy of dead and the objectification, the classification. So we live through a world of turning things into objects, unentangling them, specialization silos. At the same time, what we did was actually built a world of classification. So, and that classification theory was allowed for separation, the separation between people. And that was a way of organizing in what was seemed to be as infinite world. In that moment, I think we've reached the end of that cycle where our externalities are, you know, you can optimize for money, but if you produce huge amounts of carbon, you're creating externalities which are self-terminating us. So what's really happened is that our single points of optimizing things around us, single point optimization, has driven a world of externalities. Those externalities we can no longer ignore because we're living in a small world. And those externalities are feedbacking into us. So whilst that describes the problem, I think what that starts to say is that the solution is a new way of relating to the world. And our hypothesis is there is ownership was a means to drive stewardship. Ownership as its mechanism was actually how you'd caretake for something in a longitudinal sense. Increasingly, ownership has become abstracted to the rights of profit and the rights of extracted value, as opposed to recognizing all the other bundles of rights. So I think we're living in an age where we have to recognize the entangled value of things and recognize and optimize for those entangled values rather than points of single point optimization. Now, that's one part. What that's married by is actually a shift in our bureaucratic capacity. Now, I'm sorry if this is slightly boring, but that's why we call it the boring revolution. But in a sense, our whole world has been built around the idea of the private contract. Contract between two parties. And what's happened is the private contract has been the framework of how we've made and constructed the world around us. What's changing is that with machine contracting capability, we can build contracts between 10,000 people or 10,000 actors. We can look at programmed agency, programmed autonomy of things in ways that could never be understood before. So there's a bureaucratic revolution that's going on that's allowing us to work and operate in an entangled manner, which is far closer to our being and our natural way of seeing the world and operating in the world and re-entangling us. But this is not an entanglement of the old world. It's a machine, ecological, human entanglement in a completely different world. And that's why increasingly I think we have to start to talk about this as a new theory of wholeness and a new theory of entanglement, which is machine-assisted, which allows us to bring our enlightenment perspective and our relational perspective and bring the two together into a new worldview. And that, I think, is a 400-year revolution. And it's a revolution as big as the Renaissance was, but in a fundamental transition of our worldview, how we relate, how we see value. Let me give you a very simple example of that. The High Line in New York. The High Line in New York cost about $173 million to build. Brilliant people. It's a trust that still struggles to look after itself. Extraordinary. Now, if you just took 10% of the land value it generated for all the land adjacent to it, it would have paid for itself in under 10 months. Under 10 months. If you want to see the numbers, if you look up provocations, smart commons. We've scraped all the data, we've pulled all the data together, and we've put all the numbers in. And you can see how much. And all the taxation of all the value generation is about 107 million. It's nowhere near. But it's billions of worth of value. It's the best real estate deal would have ever happened. So what that shows is how civic goods create this spillover value. And I think what we have is the new bureaucratic capacity to organize that value and to share that value in new ways. And I'm just using the High Line as one thing. I think we can reimagine the house. I think we can reimagine the tree canopy of a city, which is where we're working with Glasgow, and we're about to start working with two other cities around the world. We can reimagine how we organize, how we invest in the mental health of a city, which is the intangible assets of a city. And how do you invest and organize those? So I think we're moving into the civic economy, which I think is a transition from the private economy. And it's a many-to-many economy, and it fundamentally changes how we organize value. And that, I think, is a revolution of how we see ourselves, how we relate to the world, and how we organize value.
I'd love to hear more about this tree canopy project in Glasgow and...
In Daegu.
Because often these ideas seem far more translatable to the countryside. I know you work a lot in London, for example. It's much harder to get our heads around how you can transfer great ideas about the new built environment, the revolution you describe, when you're talking about big, sprawling, busy cities where you're nowhere near a park or a tree. You can be for miles nowhere near any green space.
So let's look at it. Why? So... A tree is currently a cost on the balance sheet of a local authority because they have to maintain it and they have to insure it. And those are real costs. Yet the benefits of trees, which are can be up to 10 degrees worth of cooling in a city in summer, can be, if you get it right and you plant appropriately and you build the right nature-based solutions, can be reduction of flooding risks. If you get the planting mix right and male and female trees, because currently we largely plant one sex of trees, which means that 98% is single sex, which is to reduce the need to maintain sort of clean up after trees.
It's 1% of it's male trees we mostly plant, isn't it? Very, yeah. Very amazing. How did I guess? No, I think I have read about that, but slightly unsurprising.
And that's largely because it's about the stewardship cost and the maintenance cost. Now, but what that means is that you get higher levels of asthma because the pollen levels are higher. And that means we actually have saved money on cleaning up after having appropriate mix of planting and outsourced that money to our healthcare costs. Mm. So when you start to look at these benefits, and I'm just using these as some of the benefits, there's loads of others, you start to realize that the investment of planting not one tree, but to changing the tree canopy of a city has a massive infrastructure-like quality to the outcomes of the city. And that requires us to be able to invest in the tree canopy, not the tree, and to actually transform those liabilities and be able to price the management of those liabilities. It's the equivalent of infrastructure investment as you would with a sewer pipe, you would do with a tree canopy. And I think that requires a completely different relationship. And we also know that's not just about the monetization of it. It's also about building a new relationship with those environments. So how do we get citizens involved in the curation and the working with trees? There's a brilliant project that was done, and I can't remember the name of the project, but I was going to describe it. City Lab Berlin did a lovely project in Berlin where they basically invited citizens to water their trees when they were in tree stress. Melbourne, there's a project where people they gave email addresses to trees where people were able and people were writing love letters to trees. So how do we transform the relationship of humans to trees not to be transactional, but to be a genuine relationship of looking after our environment in deeply different ways? How do we use technology to advance those realities? How do we use machine learning to be able to advance those abilities to care? How do we build a civic use of machine learning capabilities to be able to advance that? So I think that there is a monetary level story of actually the infrastructure level value of some things, but there's also a relational story in building that differently. And those two things combine together to create what I think are the new hybrid economies of these civic assets. They're not all monetary economies.
Talk a lot about the civic and citizens, but what about governments and politicians? In your experience, are they on board?
I think...
And that's a huge generalization, but absolutely. Where you've seen it.
So I think it's becoming increasingly clear to politicians that we're having to think about the scale of the problem in a different way. I think we've been used to incrementalism, but when we look at the scale of the challenge, we're looking at whole city transitions of an order of magnitude that we've not discussed. We've been talking at Cloisters, for example, up to 1.2 billion people being on the move as a result of climate change effects. We know it's certainly half a billion by 2050. So we're talking about vast population shifts. We know within Europe, people are moving from Southern Europe to Northern Europe. There's a population drift going on. So we know there's big transitions in our cities coming. Our cities are going to become hotter, wetter, and that's going to affect everywhere. Our energy systems are becoming more volatile. Our food systems are becoming more volatile. We're living in probably one of the greatest transitions of volatilities that we've ever lived in. That's going to require large-scale transitions. And we don't even have the material, the hydrocarbons to mine the materials to retrofit our cities. So there are no simple solutions. And we need to start to think much more clearly, like we're operating in a new Marshall Plan age, rather than we're operating in the age of sort of tinkering with monetary economics and we're going to just get it right. So I think we're operating at a fundamentally different scale. I think politicians are starting to recognize that. I think we have to give ourselves permission to say the scary things. Because it's not about making people afraid, it's about acknowledging the scale of the challenge and thereby permitting us to operationalize at that scale of that challenge. Because I think the biggest worry would be that we don't acknowledge the challenge. And I think we have to start to think about ourselves as post-war Europe and what is the scale of the transition that's required to be able to do that. And that is really critical. And it has to be an integral transition. A carbon-only transition won't be good enough. We need to talk about actually it being an integral transition. We know if we deal with carbon but don't deal with biodiversity, we're in trouble. We know if we don't deal with human health in a much more fundamental way, and the social care costs will be fundamentally different. And that's because we cannot deal with carbon by itself. We have to deal with carbon, biodiversity, care, a new human development economy, a new machine economy in an integral transition. And that has to work into the fact that we have to work into the reality of the embodied carbon and materiality that we've already spent and expended in building our cities and places already. So this is going to be a transition in a deep sense. We're going to have to reimagine our energy costs, our energy forms. We're going to have to reimagine our food systems. We're going to have to reimagine some of those structural flows into our city and the human development frameworks through that integral lens.
You mentioned carbon. I'm really interested about zero carbon buildings. I wonder if you could explain what that is in a nutshell, whether that's something we should even be aspiring to.
I mean, the objective of a zero carbon building would be over a lifetime, it would have net zero carbon impact. And that would have to look at not only the embodied carbon that's deployed into it, but actually the operational carbon. So is it naturally year on year sequestering carbon? So a really net zero building would sequester the carbon that's embodied into it over a lifetime of its building. So over the lifetime, it has net zero implications. That's what you would be talking about. And that is possible, but that's possible only if it's not just at the building level, you have to look at the whole plot level and look at the whole plot in an integrated sense in that frameworks. And you have got to look at that complete lifestyle analysis. The big challenge is that we're not measuring them, we're not building the kind of the regulation to hold to account for embodied carbon in a building, we're not measuring the in-life use of the carbon in the building, and we're not actually balancing those things. So I think there's the regulatory frameworks, the registries of those data, and then pricing that. Where's the incentive to price that? So should there be effectively a carbon sinking fund? So if you aren't able to do that, you have to allocate that money to a digital sinking fund, which means that there's incentive to restore that carbon after the life of that building. So I think we have to create I don't think we should be using fiscal mechanisms, governmental mechanisms, but we need to create the new balancing financial institutions and infrastructures around the building, which can be digitated, automated, and warrantied to be able to create a new form of balancing mechanism. So we're going to require the capacity to measure it, require the capacity to price it perhaps even, and to build those institutions around that.
And that's what you're doing with your business and your company and your ethos is working with those various institutions to make those changes.
Exactly. And building for example, like, if you're looking at soil sequestration, right? So we're building, how would you build a digital smart wallet that's attached to the land registry, which means that if you degrade the soil with your farming practice, you contribute small amounts of money to that wallet. That means when you can use that money to restore that land, and you can auto-proof the restoration of that land. So what we're building is the digital institutional infrastructures at a micro level that allow us to be able to do this at the local rather than trying to accumulate this all at the national, fiscal, governmental level. And that's to do with building particularity and building local responses.
Absolutely fascinating. It's quite hard not to want to ask you about a lot more, but I have to let you go. I'm just going to ask one last question. We're here at the Closeness Forum, an extraordinary lot of people here, so many different voices and coming at this from different places, different mindsets, different angles. Anything that's surprised you, anything particular you take away from the experience?
I think the big things I take away, one is the extraordinary quality of the people here. I think the second thing I take away is the kind of, I think, quite a unanimous agreement that the scale of what we're talking about and the scale of action required, which I think is really, really both refreshing, because I think we often look at a project level and we're not really looking at the kind of what I'd call a societal transition level. And I think the third thing I really take away is, even in this group of people, what the kind of spectrum of work that's going on to be able to deal with this challenge. So I have great hope. Coming out of the forum, I have great hope and great need, great respect and great kind of need to get going. I think the big thing I would say is that I think holding the scale of the challenge need not be a place of fear. Holding the scale of the challenge is an invitation for our generation to do something extraordinary. And I think that's the invitation. And I think we mustn't take anything for granted in that sense. All these ideas that we have, even the private limited company was born 200 years ago, 300 years ago. Everything that we think is the constitution of the world around us is able to be redesigned. And we need to give our generation the permission to actually redesign these fundamentals. Redesign ownership, I think, has to be one of the big challenges of the 21st century. And I think there are whole new classes of organizing that are emerging, which will not be about ownership or rent, but actually self-owning things. And I think that's going to open up a whole new class of how we see the world and humans' relationship to the world. So I think let's accept the kind of fundamentals. I think let's accept the scale. And I think the other language that I really enjoyed in the forum is a language of what I would call embracing the reality of a planetary civilization. Embracing the reality that we are operating already in a planetary civilization. And what does it mean to operate civilly in a planetary organism? All of our flows, all of our food systems, nutrient systems, our machines, they're all part of a planetary network. We're reliant on planetary weather systems, we're finding out very quickly. So I think the planetary conversation, I think, is a really important one. And it's not one world and one world government, but it's recognizing our planetary interdependence. So that's another thing that I think is really, I think that voice has come repeatedly through, which I think has been both refreshing but also critical. And I think the fourth thing I'd say is that I think it's really important to recognize that after World War II, extraordinary things were done. And I think we have to give ourselves permission for extraordinary things. And I think and looking back into World War II, or looking back into 1833 when the UK abolished slavery, I think those moments invite us to be our bigger selves. And I think this is going to be the great challenge for our generation, is to actually move away from tinkering and actually embrace the art of what is possible. And we have embraced the reality of having done extraordinary things. And that's what we're going to require, not just at a European level, but at a planetary level. And that's a powerful invitation for us.
Thank you so much. That feels like a very optimistic place to end, the possibility of doing the extraordinary. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to In Line with Nature, brought to you by the Closeness Forum, hosted by me, Hannah McInnes, produced by Claire Heaton, and supported by the wonderful team at the Closeness Forum. We'd love to hear your thoughts, suggestions,
or any questions you might have about the episode, just send your email to podcast@theclosetersforum.com and make sure to tune in for our next instalment.